This week's Undisclosed Addendum is brought to you by our most delicious sponsor, Blue Apron. Listen in for the Blue Apron spot later in the show and make sure to support Blue Apron because Blue Apron supports us. Until then, enjoy the program.
Hello, and welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. I am John Cryer, and you are listening to the podcast about all things undisclosed. Now, in episode 12 of Undisclosed, Exit Wounds, Colin and Susan deconstructed the state of Georgia's ballistic evidence against Joey Watkins and discovered some troubling discrepancies between what they found and what they actually testified to that clearly favored the prosecution. Now, with us today is one of the hosts of Undisclosed, Colin Miller. He is an associate dean and professor of law at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and he blogs at Evidence Prof Blog. Hello, Colin. How you doing?
Hey, John. Pretty good.
All right. But we also have guests this week. Our first guest is Congressman Keith Ellison. He's the U.S. representative for Minnesota's 5th Congressional District since 2007. He's the co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus and the chief deputy whip. He serves on the House Committee on Financial Services, but he's also a longtime defense attorney and the host of We the Podcast, which you should check out if you get a chance. You might also remember him from the recent TV hit, the C-SPAN Wells Fargo Comedy Hour, which were the congressional hearings that looked into the fraud at Wells Fargo. Now, full disclosure, I was the voice of Wells Fargo commercials for about 5 years. It was Seize Yours Someday, Wells Fargo. That was me. I was surprised that I was not called before the congressional committee. I was expecting that phone call at some point. But I have to say, I defrauded relatively few people. not as many. But actually, Congressman, it's great to have you here. But I wanted to ask you just for a quick rundown. It was confusing to me as a consumer of news exactly how the fraud that Wells Fargo was committing actually worked, because I understood that it was creating fake bank accounts. But what beyond that?
Well, there are a number of things that they were doing. One is they would use high pressure tactics to get people to open accounts. They would use these long lists of people who had bought other products, maybe one product, and call them up and just push all these other products on them. They call them the Great Eight. So it would start out with high pressure sales tactics. Then after they got folks to open up accounts that they didn't need, they might actually open up credit cards on those accounts that the consumer never authorized. So that happened quite a bit. And there were even some lines of mortgage equity lines, things like that, that were never authorized by the consumer. Now, it's also important to note that opening up all these accounts, you wonder, like, what's that about? Well, if you don't maintain a certain minimum balance on your account, you will be charged a fee. And the level of the fee depends upon the nature of the account. So if you have something that might be a cash management account, that's one thing. A checking account is another. Simple saving might be another. But at the end of the day, if you can get somebody to open up about 6 or 7 accounts and they only really use 1 or 2, then you could probably generate substantial fees from those sort of dormant accounts. So that was sort of what it was all about. But some of it was a little bit of identity theft. Some of it was
just a little bit of identity theft.
a little bit of that.
We're dipping our toe in identity theft.
Right, right. But that was sort of how it worked. 5,300 people were let go. The company says that they all had engaged in unethical conduct. But I will say that there is a group of employees who is keeping a close eye on this situation and who is advocating for employees. And they say that a lot of people who were fired amongst those 5,300 were people who simply did not meet sales goals. The workers would describe a situation where every morning they would have sales huddles. And people were saying, everybody has to sell 3 credit cards today, open up a certain number of accounts every day, a lot of pressure. And if you didn't do them, you have your name put on a list for not making your sales goals. So public shaming. And then your pay was sort of tied to meeting these sales goals. And these folks had base pay of like $12 an hour. If you want to do better than that, you had to really move these products. So that sort of was a very tough environment to work in for a lot of people. And many of those people contest this claim that all 5,300 were let go for unethical conduct. And by the way, we're talking about 2 million separate transactions that were ethically tainted. So it was kind of wide ranging. And the real fight at the committee hearing was, you know, okay, Mr. CEO, you're going to let go of all these people and then tell the public that we've handled the problem. But the problem didn't crop up overnight. It had something to do with your sales system, your high pressure tactics, and the unrelenting pressure on the workers to just move the merchandise. So that's kind of the nature of the conversation.
Well, also a big part of the conversation was apparently the CEO of Wells Fargo, John Stumpf, claiming he just didn't know. There's a marvelous supercut floating around of all the times he had to say he did not know. Now, obviously, the CEO of a company isn't going to know on a terribly granular basis exactly what's going on. But it seemed like the hearings were an opportunity to expose behavior that, while much of it wasn't necessarily illegal, was certainly unethical.
Yeah, and I'll say this. I think that if you're paying somebody $22 million a year, they might want to know something about the sales program that's being delivered to the public.
Perhaps.
You know, look, I have no problem with people making a good living, but if you're going to make that living, justify your existence by knowing what's going on in your company. Now, as you said, they can't know every single thing, but if you have a system in place that says this is what is expected to sell, then I think that he ought to know. So, like, one question I didn't get a chance to ask him is, why did you discontinue your sales goals program if you don't even know what's wrong with your sales goals program? Because, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with having a sales goals program for employees. I think it has to do with how much pressure are you putting? What are the consequences for not meeting them? And are they fair? Are they ethical? And do they serve the public? There are sales programs that are not good, and there are those that are just fine. Why was his at Wells Fargo unacceptable? He could not answer that question. And along with many other questions. And so I got the impression that I wasn't exactly getting candid answers from the CEO, Mr. Stumpf.
Well, thank you for filling me in on that. On today's show, we also have another guest, and his name is James Wyrick. He's a retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel. He's a lawyer and a podcaster, and his podcast, Military Justice, can be followed at @podcastmj. And I've just listened to the first episode, and I think it's terrific, and looking for more. Welcome to the show, James.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Now, I notice our producer, Dennis Robinson, just refers to you as Wyrick. Is that what you prefer?
James is, I've always thought that I sound like a carriage driver from medieval times. So Wyrick's always the preferred nomenclature.
Yes, but the way he says it, he always sounds kind of dismissive. He's always like, Wyrick, like you've been bugging him for a while.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go. But a terrific first episode, and I'm very much looking forward to your coverage of the Bo Bergdahl case. Actually, you mentioned that there's been a lot of things going on in the case recently. Could you go into that a little bit?
Yeah, well, I think some of the things that we've seen in the Bo Bergdahl case illustrate at least my belief in the need for some fundamental reforms to the military justice system, that we still have commanders, you know, non-legal trained commanders in charge of military justice that are subject to outside pressures, and that the modernization of the military justice process would include removing them, at least from some crimes. And we've seen that proposed by Senator Gillibrand, and it's got bipartisan support for a number of years, but has never been able to overcome the filibuster.
Well, but could you explain to me exactly how commanding officers operate in those situations? Now, I'm a layperson. I was on an episode of NCIS. That's as close as I've gotten to the military justice system. So what function do commanding officers actually fulfill in that situation?
Well, in the military, the commanding officer acts much like a U.S. attorney. I mean, they have the ability to determine what charges are going to be brought. For example, in the Bergdahl case, you had General Abrams. There's a preliminary hearing called an Article 32 investigation, much like a grand jury, that recommended that the case go to a misdemeanor court. And the commanding officer, General Abrams, overturned that decision, instead sent it to a felony court. We've also just had a recent ruling by the trial judge, but there were previous public statements, one by Senator McCain, where he said that as head of the Senate Armed Services Committee, he would be holding hearings if Bergdahl wasn't punished in this case. So I think from a just a fundamental fairness point of view, that's really really calls that system a little bit into question. So it's a good case to illustrate some of the changes that would be good for those who protect our nation.
So the Bergdahl case was originally going to be referred to a misdemeanor court. That's just surprising to me only because, you know, desertion was obviously considered with tremendous gravity in the military. That was the first recommendation?
Yeah, that was the recommendation by the lawyer, the lieutenant colonel lawyer who conducted the grand jury investigation called the Article 32, but similar to a grand jury.
So as I said, as a layperson, I don't expect commanders to have that skill set at all. My hope is that a commander knows how to defend our country militarily. That's all that I ask of he or she. Frankly, I don't demand that they know all about the legal process. I'm surprised that that has been delegated to commanders. Is that just a function of...
It's historical.
Yeah.
It goes back 200 years ago. So it's one of those... It's one of the reforms that we, at least in my opinion, that we need for the military that we've just held on to out of tradition. It's only been 5 years ago that we had open homosexual service in the military. The military is a little slow to adapt to changing times. So we need our legislators to push them in the enlightened direction.
Well, yes. And also, you've pointed out on the podcast that we're now in our 15th year of being a country at war. And so we've had millions of people processed through the military in that time and have had to experience, some interaction with the military justice system. And interestingly, I wanted to bring up, there's been a couple of cases in the news recently that I wanted to bring up. One is the Janae Irvin protest case. She was an intelligence specialist in the reserve who refused to stand for the national anthem. My understanding is she is being reprimanded in some way. But I wondered what, you know, in the military, it doesn't seem a natural place for free speech. It's the military. But you're not, I guess when you're joining, you're not giving up your civil rights. Am I correct?
Well, you probably are. And first, I've gone on record before. I absolutely support the actions of Colin Kaepernick. I wish he was just a little better at quarterback. But absolutely, you know, that type of protest, that's what our people of character should be doing in our nation. That being said, my recommendation to the sailor would be definitely there's Article 92. There's violations of a general regulation or order. And although the Navy's saying right now that they're just investigating it, putting my criminal defense attorney hat on, that would be definitely a violation for her to do that while in uniform. And I think we can kind of understand that in the sense that while we might agree with what she's saying, if you had service members going to other types of rallies and things, we would not want them representing the United States military at such rallies.
Well, also on a day-to-day basis, I don't know how one would maintain military discipline if everybody's taking a moment to honor their particular political beliefs.
Right.
I mean, I understand why the military appears ossified because, you know, it's an organization with an incredibly important, deadly mission.
And she would still be, she's still free to, you know, write an op-ed or do it out of uniform. She can still hold that view for sure. But there just needs to be the disclaimer that, you know, she's not representing the views of the United States military or government.
And that's one thing that's struck me as interesting about all of the protests in terms of Colin Kaepernick and a lot of the other athletes who've taken a knee for the anthem is that people have interpreted it as an attack on the military, which always struck me as odd because it was clearly always aimed as an attack on what they perceived as police violence and having nothing to do with the military. You know, I don't know if you guys can chime in on your thoughts on how that gets conflated.
I think that you definitely have members of the military or former members that don't like the message, so they try to say this is an insult to the military. It absolutely, I'm speaking as a veteran, and I say it's not an insult to the military. It's clearly, you know, Mr. Kaepernick standing up for an important issue in our nation. And I think that that's the responsibility of all important and informed citizenry.
Thank you very much.
So say yes.
We're going to take a real short break now to check in with one of our awesome regular sponsors, Blue Apron. Now, I'm sure a lot of you have been following along online as myself, Dennis Robinson, my husband, who rarely cooks. And many of our listeners have been battling it out on Twitter with pictures of our beautiful Blue Apron meal creations. And the reason we can do this, all of us, those of us who barely cook and those of us who've been cooking for years, is because Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. And believe me, the results don't look and taste like home cooking. They taste and look like something out of a gourmet restaurant. Now, Blue Apron has partnerships with over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the U.S. So not only are your meals delicious and beautiful, they are sourced sustainably. The produce all comes from regenerative farming practices, and the beef, chicken, and pork comes from responsibly raised animals. And no matter where you are in the continental U.S., 99% of the time, Blue Apron can deliver right to your door. Not only that, but Blue Apron gives you exact amount you need of each ingredient required for a recipe. So guess what? You don't have food waste either. Now, if you're anything like me, you have been waiting impatiently for the temperatures to cool down and for us to get to autumn so we can start making fall-inspired, cozy, warm, toasty meals. And Blue Apron is right there with us because they always offer seasonally appropriate meal options and menus. And some of the meals, for example, available this month in October are crispy chicken Milanese with warm Brussels sprouts, celery and potato salad, and seared salmon and fall vegetable hash with, get this, apple brown butter dressing. Doesn't that sound amazing? And all of this you can make at home for less than $10 a meal per person. And you get new options every single week because new recipes are created every single week. And guess what? They are never repeated within a year. So you can choose your meals from a variety of recipes, or you can let their own culinary team surprise you. So check out this week's menu and get your first three meals for free with free shipping if you go to blueapron.com/UP. You are going to love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/UP. Up. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
So I wanted to get around to this week's episode of Undisclosed, because in the opening of the episode, Susan mentioned that there is a new PCAST report that would be required reading for Undisclosed listeners. And first of all, I would like to file a complaint. When I took this job, I was told there would be no homework. and if she's gonna make me, I mean, that report is 174 pages. I mean, just getting to the introduction is, that's page 34, you know, so that's a lot of stuff to wade through. But it came out, the PCAST is, I believe, the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology. And they weighed in on the state of forensic science in criminal courts. And actually, Colin, I was hoping that you could talk to us a little more about that report.
Yeah, so PCAST, as you said, it's the President's Council, and it's a group of essentially the nation's leading scientists and engineers. And what they were principally looking at was comparison evidence. You have a bite mark on a victim. What are the methods we currently use to determine whether the defendant has a distinctive bite mark that matches that bite mark? We have shoe print evidence. We have a shoe print at the crime scene. To what extent can we match that to a shoe size and type worn by the defendant? And then, as speaks to this case, we have ballistics evidence, and you're trying to match a bullet to a gun and exclude other guns. And essentially what this report says is, a lot of this comparison forensics is not independent in that the testers are beholden to the government. They're often, whether explicitly or implicitly, biased in favor of the government. They're overstating the results. And PCAST essentially asks for an overhaul of the way that forensics comparisons are done, because the current field is not sufficient. It leads to false positives and false negatives. And unfortunately, the response by the Attorney General, by district attorneys, by the FBI, is we're basically going to ignore this report. We're going to proceed with what we're doing with this evidence.
Well, I can understand on their part, because it opens up an enormous can of worms. I mean, this is, you know, my understanding is all the things you mentioned, that's the bedrock of forensic science in the criminal justice system. If it's found to be lacking, it sounded like, by the way, that there has only been only one peer-reviewed study of all of these sciences. Did I misunderstand that?
No, that's correct. A lot of these, including fingerprints, by the way, they just don't have a lot of studies that actually back it up. And there's, I think, the misconception that forensic science developed independently of the government. It was very much J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI they very much invented this field of forensic science, and it was something always seen as a tool used by the government against defendants. So it's not independent, and that's the huge problem. These are things that were developed in the petri dish of the government, and there have been some disastrous results. That's a big segment of the false conviction cases are these faulty forensic sciences.
And the FBI lab has had its own share of scandals, as a matter of fact. I think I should have brought that up when we had Jim Clemente on the show. But my understanding was the forensic lab was rife with methodology that was suspect and people testifying to things that they weren't necessarily certain of. Is that a fair judgment of it?
Yeah, the big study that came out semi-recently was the hair analysis, where it went through and showed how hair analysis is 90%+ of the time wrong and almost always in a way that hurts the defendant. And then beyond that, even when those are cases where the testimony is shaded in favor of the government, sort of the Jay Jarvis situation we discussed in this episode. But then there's these cases of quote-unquote dry labbing I've been looking into, where you had people claiming they tested drugs that were taken from the defendant, and dry labbing means they didn't actually test them. They just made up the results and used that against defendants. And that's happened in Texas. It's happened in Massachusetts. There's been a few jurisdictions where these issues have cropped up.
You know, I've tried a lot of cases to juries over the years that involve scientific evidence. Before I was in Congress, I spent 16 years doing criminal defense work. And I could tell you that it's very powerful when an expert witness takes the stand and is qualified as an expert. The jury and even the lawyers may not exactly understand everything that's being said, despite what they might represent. But it's still very powerful in the eyes of the jury. I mean, they listen to that and the guy says, you know, I've compared this and they use some jargon and this bullet matches, you know, this casing follows the bullet in the body, or this tire tread is the one of matches the car of the defendant. And it just really, really throws the things in favor of the state when that kind of evidence is admitted. And so, I mean, I think that if anybody really needs to read that PCAS report, it's got to be judges who are going to make decisions about admissibility. Because, you know, there's a scientific standard for admissibility of evidence called the Daubert standard. And this standard test, not only is it relevant, but is it reliable? And it has to meet that standard in order to be admitted. And yet reliability is like the heart of the matter. And new scientific techniques are coming online all the time. And so, I mean, I think that if anybody needs to really dig into that PCAST, it is judges throughout this country, so that they can apply a very strict standard as to whether or not a piece of scientific evidence comes in, because it is powerful once it does come in.
Well, also, my understanding is that across the United States, it's a hodgepodge of different laws in terms of what states will accept what scientific evidence. My understanding is there are still states that accept polygraph evidence. Is that true?
There's one state, New Mexico, allows polygraph results to be admitted. Beyond that, there are some jurisdictions that say if the prosecution and defense stipulate before the taking of the polygraph that the result will be admissible after the defendant takes it, then in some jurisdictions that's permissible. But New Mexico is the only one that says per se. There are some standards, but you know, without an agreement by the prosecution and defense, the polygraph evidence can come in.
Well, can I just say this about polygraph? I mean, basically, it measures a galvanic skin response. Basically, how nervous are you? How twitchy are you? And it measures at a level that even if you try to act calm, if you have a response to a certain kind of a question, that if you're lying, then that takes a certain amount of extra energy and it'll register on your skin. But let me tell you, it basically just records a skin response. It doesn't detect lies. It detects reactions. And, you know, I'm going to tell you, I've had people who took polygraphs. They weren't admissible, but two different polygraphers can come out with two different results. I had a client one time who was pregnant and the polygraph administrator didn't even know it. And I'm like, well, wait a minute. You got two heartbeats going on here. You got the mom and you got the baby. How come you didn't know that? And so in my opinion, it really is a tactic just to sort of like up the ante on somebody who's claiming that they're innocent and, you know, making them think that there's something there. I just think it's a shame that a polygraph could ever be introduced as evidence. But again, you know, it seems sciencey, so people think that it might be valuable.
Congressman, if I may, if I could summarize this, Polygraph machines are voodoo, and they are a machine to try to get confessions out of defendants. Because
bingo.
They will use the follow-up questions of, well, I had some problems with question number three, and could you clarify this? Hey, if you don't say I had a problem with your x-ray, can you tell me if your arm's broken? Either the machine works or it doesn't, buddy.
Right.
Tying those last two points together, too, is there's a well-known effect, the white coat effect, which is if you're going to see a doctor, you're stressed. If you're a suspect asked to speak to a polygrapher about a crime, you're stressed, and that can cause these results in polygraph tests that aren't real. And then, Congressman, going back to your point about these experts and how much reliability jurors place in them, well, that white coat effect applies there too, in the sense that if you have a forensic expert, if you have someone who is being proffered as an expert in the field of ballistics or fingerprint evidence or hair evidence, jurors put so much weight into that testimony, and that's a huge problem. And that's why the screening effect of the Daubert test or the Fry test is so essential. And it's interesting, we'll see what the defense bar does with this PCAST report, but you can imagine starting as of a few weeks ago when this came out, that defense attorneys at these hearings and before jurors are going to be arguing, look, this evidence being presented, we have this body of the state's experts saying it's unreliably done and it's not something you should take on faith.
It sounds like part of the reason that they might be hesitant to institute these reforms is that, as I said, it opens up an enormous can of worms. But also, all of these methods have been of late proving very problematic. And if they are, in fact, disproven, I don't know where you begin to go over the enormous backlog of cases that were decided on the basis of this.
Well, you know, this is a good point, John, because if you really start looking at some of the scientific evidence that has been the basis of a conviction, you're going to start looking at a lot of convictions. The thing is that so much of the comparison type evidence, you know, I think in a way, I mean, I feel mixed. It should meet a very high threshold to be admitted. And then, of course, I think there should be some instruction, some way for the judge to demonstrate to the jury that they have every right to question this evidence without sort of like dipping into the defense attorney's role. But I think that the white coat effect is just so powerful that there's got to be some kind of a curative instruction that, look, you cannot just assume that this stuff is right. It's not necessarily right. You have a right to question it. Maybe a judicial instruction might be a way to get a fair evaluation of this evidence.
And actually, I've been looking at the first page of the PCAST report because I can't be depended on to read the whole thing. And that's why I was asking Colin to summarize it for me. But the recommendations do sound fairly commonsensical. They don't sound like they're crazy. They want the National Institutes of Standards and Technology. They should perform evaluations on an ongoing basis of the scientific validity of current and newly developed forensic feature matching technologies and should issue an annual public report on the results. Well, that makes sense. It's kind of hard to justify turning that down, especially since that would provide enormous guidance to the states who at this point have to wait for various cases to be brought up for them to overturn scientific evidence. I imagine that's the process.
Yeah. And if you look further in the report, I mean, this is basically the scientific method. They say foundational validity. If you're going to introduce this comparative evidence, you need, I'm reading from the report, a reproducible and consistent procedure for one, identifying features in evidence samples, two, comparing the features in two samples, and three, determining based on the similarity between the features in two sets of features, whether the sample should be declared to be likely to come from the same source, and then B, empirical estimates from appropriately designed studies from multiple groups that establish the method's false positive rate and the method sensitivity, that is, the probability it declares a proposed identification between samples that actually came from the same source. So, I mean, that is just the scientific method there. They're just asking that to be used when you have this comparison evidence. And, yeah, the Attorney General, the FBI is saying, we're not going to do it. We're fine with the way we do things. Standard operating procedure is going to be what continues for the foreseeable future.
So, hey, what is the – if we were going to put a number on the rate of exonerations of people being convicted, do we have any kind of even a ballpark number on that? I've heard it's as high as 10%, but I'm not sure that's accurate. Does anybody know?
Of people exonerated in what respect? Exonerated by forensic evidence or?
Well, after they've been convicted, they've been later found to be, their conviction was vacated based on actual innocence.
Oh, you know what? I'm not aware of that, actually. I've bandied about the false confession statistic way too much because people are getting mad at me about it now. But yeah, I'm not aware. I think that would be a statistic that would be very difficult to derive because there's so many reasons that people could be exonerated.
But you could take the sum total of people convicted in a given year, and then you could stretch it out, I don't know, maybe 10 years, and then just say how many of those people have been found to be exonerated and, you know, convictions vacated. And I'd be curious to know. I mean, some of them would be eyewitness testimony. Some would be false confessions. And I want to thank you for the episode you did on that. That was awesome. But I mean, I bet you there'd be a substantial number where there's forensic scientific evidence that played a role in the case where the evidence either was not sound or was applied in an unsound way or was misapplied. I mean, I would guess this would be a driver of how people end up being convicted. I'm just curious to know.
It's 46% of DNA exonerations, invalid forensic science evidence played a role in the case. Almost half. That's pretty significant. Yeah, I don't know in terms of the overall percentage. I think that would probably understate it because there's so many people still in prison who are innocent and haven't been released yet, and it's tough to get that. But so I don't know about the overall number. Yeah, but 46% of DNA exoneration involved faulty forensic science evidence.
And I tell you, John, one reason why I think that this is critically important is because, you know, the judges tell the jury that the defendant is presumed innocent. The defense attorney and the judge say that they got to prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt. But, you know, the defendant being brought in there, just being accused, those instructions, I don't know if they really matter. I mean, I know that people try to take their oath seriously. I believe that. But just the circumstances just sort of create this overwhelming impression that this guy is the one who did it. So just getting more news and information out there on how often, you know, exonerations do happen and the role that forensic evidence plays, I think is key, particularly some of the stuff in the popular media. You know, we're just led to believe, you know, forensic evidence is just conclusive. The TV tells us that every night.
Well, also people generally want to believe that the state is doing things by the book. And by the way, you know, in the United States, the state is pretty transparent. I mean, the reason we're aware of all of these problems is because we're talking about them. We can make a podcast about them. And so, you know, hopefully when people serve on juries, when they see the defendant brought before them, they won't automatically assume that what the state is presenting them is absolutely the case. But unfortunately, these labs that are run by the state governments come in with the imprimatur of that. They are the state or the FBI, which, of course, has a very powerful reputation. But in this case, actually, in the Joey Watkins case, it's interesting because Colin and Susan pointed out two very subtle areas where that bias can come through in a lab. First being the actual instructions that are posed to the lab, what the prosecutor is asking the lab to find can be, you know, tricky because they're basically saying, here's what we want you to say. And Colin, are there any ideas floating around in terms of how do we fix that? How can we make it so that labs aren't given instructions of basically what they're supposed to find?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And I think that that is definitely an area that is essential. And I'm not aware, other than sort of having these labs that are completely independent from the state, where you would really solve the problem. Because right now it is just this idea where the lab is an extension of the prosecutor's office. And when you have that, you're going to have the prosecutor coming in and saying, or the police coming in and saying, listen, we need this to match this. We need it not to match that. Please write your report in a way that is going to be most helpful to our case. That's essentially what Jay Jarvis told us in this case.
The other thing that you guys brought up was his interesting use of language on the stand by saying that the findings were consistent with a 9mm Ruger. He was, in fact, giving the impression that it matched a 9mm Ruger. But what, in fact, what he was saying was he wouldn't rule out a 9mm Ruger. Is that correct?
Yeah, and it's very similar to what we discussed in our first season case, the Adnan Syed case, where there were these two hairs found on the clothes of the victim, Haman Lee, and it was clear from what this person testing the hair had found that Adnan Syed could be ruled out as the source of the hair, and so could Haman Lee. But the way it was presented on the stand, very similar to Jay Jarvis in this case, made it look much more equivocal than that, and the jurors in that case were not at all certain that the hairs came from someone else. And in this case, as you know, it made it seem this was open and shut. The three parts of the bullet, the jacket, the lead core, and the cartridge case all came from a 9mm. You could link them together, and in actuality, when Jarvis was talking to Claire and Susan, it became quite clear that significantly overstated the weight of his conclusion.
Yeah, I was particularly offended by the idea that he could say it came from a 9mm Ruger. That's like saying I've identified these Michelin tires and they were on a Honda Civic. No, they could have been on any vehicle. And just because you identified it as a 9mm, I mean, there's Ruger is one of 100 different handguns that fire 9mm, at least 100. So that type of testimony I found to be, that's an extraordinary jump to say that it came from that make of gun.
So a question for Keith, actually, and for Colin. So is that going to mean that in these kind of situations, it's always just going to be incumbent upon the defense attorney to poke that hole and say, you're saying consistent, but what you mean is we're not ruling it out?
Well, that is going to be the primary responsibility of the defense attorney, which is scary, given that you got so many public defender offices all over this country that are overburdened, and then you have this situation where people not getting discovery in adequate time to really challenge it. So it's kind of scary, you know, but the answer is that's their primary responsibility. But, you know, John, I would go a little further and say I think it is the court's responsibility. You know, the court cannot, in my opinion, just say, I'm here to just call balls and strikes. The court has to make sure there is a fair trial. And to me, that means that the court may have to ask that question or make sure that there is an in limine hearing to make sure that these issues are brought out. And, you know, judges are authorized to ask questions in the trial. I've seen it many times. You don't want them to ask questions that really prejudice your case. But if it's key for the jury to know it, to make a fair decision, I think the court does need to intervene and make sure that the jury's aware of that.
Yeah, that's a great point. There's Rule 614 of the Rules of Evidence allows judges to interrogate witnesses. And I think that's spot on to say, if you are a judge in the courtroom, if defense counsel has not stepped up and really dug into the question of what is consistent with mean, and you're the judge sitting there and knowing the jurors are likely to overvalue that, yeah, I mean, you can certainly in a neutral fashion simply follow up with the expert and ask, can you please explain exactly what you mean by consistent with? How far does that go? How far doesn't it go? And just make sure the jurors understand exactly the weight they should give to that expert's conclusion.
Yeah, you know, a lot of times I've seen trials where the judge just kind of takes a hands-off approach and says, well, you know, it's your case, counsel. But I mean, when you're talking about somebody's liberty, maybe, you know, you might be talking about a murder case or something very important to the victims as well and their family. You know, I think the judge has an important role to play to make sure the jury understands that.
What I'll add on that, too, is a majority of jurisdictions, vast majority, jurors can ask questions. I'm of the opinion that I support the minority of jurisdictions where jurors, through the judge, they submit the questions to the judge and have the judge ask them, so you don't know which juror is asking the question. But I think that by allowing jurors to take part in that way, it makes them more active in engaging in the proceedings and allows them in these cases where I think probably the forensics and expert evidence is something that's the most confusing to them. It allows them to ask something like that where they can say, can you please explain further what is meant by your conclusion that this cartridge case or this leg core is consistent with a 9mm. And I think that's something the court should definitely consider.
The military, we do that quite a bit. We have our jurors ask quite a few questions.
Or rather, your members, as they call them.
Yeah, the members do. Congressman, they submit them written to the judge. Then they're showed to both counsel. And then we lodge our objections and they're handed back to the judge. And then he or she asked directly.
Quick question. Who is the authority on forensic science for the military justice system? Does it vary from service to service? Does the Navy have a different standard of what forensic science they'll let into their courts than, say, the Army?
No, it's standardized. The Army has a central lab down in Georgia, but the different services do run, like the Navy will run a lab for your analysis cases. And it's just, you know, because we have a lot of drug cases that are the result of random urinalysis. But it's just like the congressman said that, you know, you have a scientist that is mostly working with the prosecution, and he comes in there and talks about agrolites, and you know, it gives all the clinical definition and all the gold standard machinery they have. It's a pretty impressive presentation when you're trying to deal with that as a defense attorney.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of defense attorneys, I don't think it's required that they get any specialization in, say, DNA or certain kind of forensic evidence. I mean, you might have somebody who's been out of law school for 6 months and has a ton of cases, gets discovery late. And, you know, that's why you get a lot of people pleading, because, you know, you get some scared to death. A defense attorney says, look, you know, we're done for. It might as well seek a deal. And then, you know, the prosecutor can name their price. So all these things kind of come together to make for, I think, a criminal justice system that could be a lot better. In saying that, I'll even say that we probably do have the best criminal justice system in the world, or I'll say one of them, but that doesn't mean we're as good as we could be. And given the just sheer number of people who've been let out of, got off death row because of bad forensics or bad DNA, it's worth it.
Absolutely. We should all be agitating for a better system. It makes for a better nation.
Absolutely. I mean, I worry sometimes that people won't have confidence in the criminal justice system if we do not really sort of make sure that these convictions have integrity. There's a new show coming out, John, this is kind of in your area, called Conviction Integrity Unit. I think it's pretty cool because it's kind of the opposite of Law and Order, you know. it's saying, hey, you guys, these things aren't always right.
Yes, absolutely. I think actually they sponsored the show, as a matter of fact.
So can we write another portion where Ducky actually grew up, got a PhD, and ran that ran that integrity unit?
Yes, but he did it with a flair for fashion.
yes, absolutely.
Yes, I'd do that show. But you know,
I'd love to watch it.
I am one of the people who believe that you can't shine enough attention on this kind of stuff. And so I'm hoping, obviously, that the show's a hit and that it brings this stuff to mind. I also think a lot of people don't even know that a lot of states have these conviction integrity units. And I know I didn't know it until very recently. And I think it's such a laudable concept for the state to say, hey, wait a minute, let's look at this again. You know, as long as they're not a rubber stamp outfit. Because, you know, obviously any bureaucracy can make huge mistakes. When we look at the criminal justice system, we're hoping that it is a process that has over the years evolved enough that it's worked out all the kinks, you know, and we're going to get as close to the truth as we possibly can get. But obviously, these forensic sciences that we are employing on a daily basis in this situation are clearly flawed in many ways, you know, and that's not even to mention how the evidence is gathered. You know, it's only since the O.J. Simpson case that they take a lot greater care in collecting this evidence in terms of contamination and all these things. So, you know, but I think the public yearns to have some certainty in these situations. And, you know, this is just how people try to provide it.
Oh, yeah. So I think the popular media has an important role to play here, you know, raise, like you said, O.J., you know, helping. And I think actually, you know, art can drive real life, you know.
I agree. Now, I actually, because I so approve of the concept of jurors asking questions, I'm going to take a question from Twitter. that was a nice segue right there. Here's one. This is from Big Grizzy Chap. I love the tag names here. He says, vague ballistics point to a handgun never owned by Watkins. How can this be evidence? And I've actually heard that from a lot of people who don't understand why the court was trying to make this connection when it didn't appear that Joey even actually owned this gun.
Yeah, I mean, that goes back to, if you recall, a few episodes back now, I guess, Adam Elrod, who had this story of Joey supposedly purchasing a 9mm handgun from a man with a scraggly beard at a gas station. And that's pretty much it. They tried to say, look, Adam says he bought this 9mm. We have these three pieces of a bullet, and our expert Jay Jarvis is saying it's a 9mm, and you can link the two together, and that's how you can conclude he used a 9mm handgun to kill Isaac Dawkins. That was pretty much the strength of the state's case right there.
And we had a corollary question from Big Grizzy Chap again, which is, Heath owns handguns and has allegedly fired upon others on the highway. How can Watkins, who has no handguns, be considered? Obviously, they eliminated Heath because of the time discrepancy, but it still seems like, you know, they're trying to fit a square peg in a round hole with such effort in this case.
Yeah, and that really goes back to our last two episodes on character evidence. In essence, the state's case against Joey Watkins was a mountain of character evidence. Their entire case was essentially motive to say Brianne and he broke up. Brianne started dating Isaac Dawkins. This threw him into a rage and a fury, and based upon all this character evidence we're presenting to show how he's responded in similar situations, you can conclude from that that he was the one who took Isaac Dawkins' life. Who else could it have been? And that was enough to convince the jurors in the case. And I know, obviously, we're looking back now at everything involved in the case, but there's not much more to the case than that.
To follow up on that, that amount of propensity evidence that was brought in and MO, that was just really overwhelming. I mean, I think that was one of the most damaging parts of this entire case. And this idea that we aren't focusing, you know, judges letting in this evidence and we're not focusing on the crime charged. We are spending massive amounts of time deciding, you know, if they were at a Dairy Queen and told each other to screw off and someone, you know, threw something at each other that's not even connected to the crime. It seemed like it was just a referendum on Joey Watkins as a person, and then this will be the crime that he gets convicted of.
Yeah, and sort of taking everything full circle, going back to forensics and the experts, the other component of the state's case, which we'll get to, is the cell tower pings, which again also takes us full circle to season one. So we'll have a whole episode in the cell tower pings and how they played a role in the case and what we think we can conclude from them based upon our own drive test and some experts who have reviewed the materials.
So if we're Monday morning quarterbacking, the big problem with the propensity evidence appears to have been the judge, that it was the judge who had the discretion to allow the evidence in or not. And, you know, in our estimation, it appears that they erred too much on the side of allowing the prosecution to just allow things that were completely tangential into the case. I mean, if one was to Monday morning quarterback such a thing.
I think that's part of it. I would say, number one, the way the Georgia rules are set up to allow a prosecutor to proffer as opposed to having a hearing where the defense can cross-examine. Two, I think the prosecutor, Tammy Colston, overstated things significantly. I don't know whether that was in good faith or bad faith. Three, I think definitely the judge allowed too much evidence in this case. So I think the combination of those three allowed this character evidence to inundate the jurors. And we'll have some audio from jurors we've talked about the case with. That's definitely the impression we got, is that they heard this deluge of character evidence, and that was it. That was largely enough to allow them to return a conviction.
I've got another social media question from Amy Lowe, who says, how can evidence with chain of custody issues such as this be used in court? This is startling. Does the evidence still exist, and can it be retested?
That's a great question. We've had some fights with Georgia trying to get some of this evidence. So in terms of whether the evidence still exists, there are some big question marks on that. We'll get to them in remaining episodes. In terms of the evidence getting in, and this is something, again, in our first season case with Hayes' car being released to the family's auto shop before the video was taken. We have that here with Heath Wilson's gun disappearing. I don't know. I mean, that is something that is absolutely critical for me as an evidence professor. If you are in a trial and you are defense counsel and the prosecution has not established chain of custody, that is absolutely something you need to require them to establish. And in this case, with many different pieces of evidence, that chain of custody was not even existent. And that's something definitely that could lead to the evidence being excluded, or at a very minimum, the jurors being told, we have some serious questions about what was done with this evidence.
Could that be used by the Georgia Innocence Project to try and reopen Joey's case?
No, that's something that wouldn't be grounds for appeal. That could have been raised initially on appeal, but chain of custody is not something now that's viable.
And Susan got all cryptic with that mention of an anonymous case file. Are we going to hear a little more about that, I'm hoping?
Yeah, that's something else that in the remaining episodes we will touch upon.
Ooh, I'm excited. So now, I don't know, Congressman, you're a very busy man, and obviously, Wyrick. Have you guys gotten a chance to listen to the show completely?
Yeah, I try to keep up with the show. I think it's fantastic, and I'm on an airplane going from Minneapolis to D.C. and back again. So I'm plugged in, and I really enjoyed everything you guys had to say about the character evidence episodes. And it brings me back to a point I made earlier. So much of whether or not, you know, we have equal justice is whether the judge is going to be on top of things. Because if the judge lets it in on a shaky chain of custody, unless that issue was raised on direct appeal, it might be lost. And then the Court of Appeals may decide that it's de minimis or a harmless error. I mean, so that's why, you know, it is so key to have a judge is taking careful attention to all the evidence admitted. And then also, I wish we could talk a little bit more about the need for more funds and resources to go into public defenders. There are jurisdictions in this country where public defenders are just woefully underfunded, overworked, and it just means that we get more pleas than we should have, not enough trials, and it means that innocent people go to prison. And again, when character evidence is allowed to be poured in, it just really is disturbing. One question I had about that is that, is there an ample record of the defense attorney objecting to all of that, that character evidence, that 404B evidence? I mean, how much of a fight was put up to stop that stuff from coming in?
There was somewhat of a fight, and it's tough for me to second guess because you mentioned 404B. At the time, Georgia was one of the few jurisdictions that didn't have rules of evidence modeled after the federal rules. And as I said before, Georgia doesn't require a hearing to be held where evidence can be presented and defense can cross-examine. So I'm not sure the extent to which it was, the defense falling short versus Georgia just has a system where it's exceedingly difficult for the defense to be able to put any reasonable fight up to this character evidence. So I think it's tough to disaggregate those two.
And I think along those lines, also you've had, with the passage in the early 90s of 413 and allowing in other evidence in sex crimes, I think that we've kind of conditioned our judges to allowing in propensity evidence. There's got to be a spillover effect because judges are just more accustomed to allowing in that type of evidence. And I think it's a bad turn that we've taken in criminal justice.
How did that come about? I'm not familiar with that.
Well, in the early 90s, they just passed the Federal Rules of Evidence 413 that allows in sexual assault crimes, you can admit evidence of other sexual crimes. So, I mean, I don't know exactly how it came about other than it happens in Washington and that there's sausage and law made there. But that seems to, has a spillover effect because our judges are just more accustomed now to allowing in that evidence that previously we just always disallowed, the few exceptions for modus operandi, et cetera. But for the most part, you concentrated on the charged offense. That was it. We didn't bring in, he's been convicted 3 times previously of theft, so you can consider that for his guilt this time. That was verboten. But we've let it seep back into criminal justice.
And it seems like in Georgia specifically, the laws are structured to allow that. I don't know if that was a reaction to what you were mentioning or that just evolved in Georgia on its own terms.
Yeah, it's not new with Georgia. I mean, Georgia very recently, last couple of years, did modernize their rules of evidence, but it's sort of back in 2000, 2001, their rules were a vestige of old common law rules, and that I think is something that hindered the defense. I think under the new rules, it's a lot better, but those old rules that existed until like 2013, 14, 15 were just not very helpful to the defense in trying to exclude this evidence.
So like rule 413, the original concept should be that the sexual assault needs to be similar in the way the crime was committed to sort of help the jury determine whether or not it may have been committed by the same person. But once you kick the door in and say, evidence may be considered on any matter which is relevant, when you start saying that any other sexual assault can come in, you really do damage to what I think the original concept of similar crimes evidence was supposed to be. We all know that somebody commits a crime a certain way, a certain kind of a signature. But, 413, to me, I would hope that any good judge would say, you're going to have to show that this in some way identifies the defendant, not just any other crime, because it's so incredibly prejudicial. You might as well dispense with a trial at that point.
Yeah, and this sort of cycles back to Weirich's comment before about John McCain commenting on Bo Bergdahl. Is essentially in the mid-90s, going back the whole picture, so Rule 404 says you can't have propensity character evidence. You can't prove once a burglar, always a burglar. 404B says for certain purposes like signature crime modus operandi, you can present prior crimes to show this person's a serial arsonist. They commit the arson in a very specific way. 413 through 415 says despite that general distinction, you can prove once a rapist, always a rapist, once a child molester, always a child molester. In large part, that was due to underreporting of those crimes, under conviction in those cases, jurors not believing rape victims and child molestation victims. The way those rules were accomplished, though, was Congress pushed them through, not through the regular rulemaking process. There was actually a committee of lawyers, judges, law professors who opposed those rules, and Congress overcame that. And there's been a lot of controversy surrounding those rules. Now, of course, you can understand why they have those rules. And the reasons I discussed before, those are certainly reasons why you would want to have corroborating evidence that helps the victims to prove their cases. But a lot of people disagree with the methods used. And then to Wyrick's point again, yeah, there's the possibility with those rules that judges have taken a more casual approach in terms of the admission of character evidence more broadly.
Can I just say that, you know, of all the crimes that is the worst to be accused of when you're innocent, it's got to be a sex-related crime. I mean, of course, murder is going to get you life in prison or maybe the death penalty, but you know, other than that, I guess my point is it's even more important to keep propensity evidence out of a sex crime, in my opinion.
Absolutely.
Because
yeah,
it's so inflammatory. It's just so inflammatory. It just really sends the jury over the edge. I mean, the jury is revolted by people charged with these kind of crimes. And, you know, you barely have to prove your principal case at all once you start wheeling in this other stuff.
Yes, you would have to hope for a jury blessed with equanimity beyond most human understanding for them to ignore those types of things in the past. The stigma is so huge. But one thing, actually, you were mentioning that public defenders obviously need more funding, certainly. And I've actually mentioned this before on the show, is I think we also need to vastly improve funding for evidence storage and retrieval, because it's thought of as an afterthought most of the time. And we assume the authorities have all the room in the world to store these things and all the time in the world to catalog them correctly and make sure everything is available. And it's just not the case. You know, these jurisdictions are under a lot of financial pressure. If they're faced with a lot of crime, you know, evidence storage isn't where they're going to spend their money. You know, they're going to spend it on putting more boots on the ground and more people out in the street and better equipment and all that stuff. But in terms of the transparency of the justice system, like Bob Ruff on the Truth and Justice podcast has been looking into the Edward Eights case, and there's DNA evidence that could have exonerated him. But once the state of Texas made a law to preserve all that evidence, it was all mysteriously destroyed in the Smith County evidence locker. So again, while better funding couldn't have necessarily saved that, the real integrity of these investigations is utterly dependent on evidence storage, on having access to the evidence and allowing these people who have been convicted access to it at some point if they're ever going to be given any kind of chance to overturn what could be a wrongful conviction.
I know in the Army's criminal lab about 10 years ago, they found at one point hundreds of DNA samples in one of the break room refrigerators that completely destroying the chain of custody. And I've always in my mind's eye seen them, you know, like under old birthday cake. And, you know, there's years of forensic evidence right there just destroyed.
Yeah. And speaking to the issue of rape and sexual assault, I want to congratulate and thank the congressman, among others with bipartisan support, is that the recent passage of the Rape Survivors Bill of Rights, which deals with the physical evidence recovery kits done, and it is more notice given to the rape survivor and making sure we don't destroy those kits, and it's going to help with testing. So that's something that's going to help in rape and sexual assault prosecutions that is a positive, that is a good method to achieve that. And you know, assuming that goes through, that's going to be a very positive impact in those types of cases.
Yeah, think of the political ramifications of an electorate that actually really believes that the criminal justice system works. I mean, think of how great that would be. Think of, you know, I mean, just in terms of the unrest we're going through right now, in terms of police violence and all these things, if people felt they were at least going to get a fair shot, I think it would transform the politics that are going on today. Now, Wyrick, just out of curiosity, did you have any questions that you wanted to pose for Colin, having listened to the show?
No, I just love the show.
Nothing.
I'm up to date on everything. I'm not as busy as the congressman, so I'm able to listen to every episode multiple times. And like a good member of the undisclosed family, I subscribe and listen to all shows, and especially Addendum. I really like the discussion afterwards. I think that that's been a great addition to season two, that we have the original episode and then Addendum separately. And John, if I could take one moment, it's a little bit off topic.
Okay.
But if the listeners could kindly go to my Twitter feed and look at the top tweet. I've talked to the family this week. We've got a young soldier named Shadow McLean missing about 30 days from Fort Campbell. I know the listeners are very passionate. I talked to the family this week. Any help we could get in that case would be so greatly appreciated.
Well, thank you for letting us know. I will do that right after we finish recording, as a matter of fact.
Thank you very much.
And thank you, Congressman, for being here. And thank you, Wyrick. That's how I'm going to refer to you from now on, with a little edge.
Wyrick?
Wyrick. Like you just ruined something of mine. Like
yes,
you
yes,
just
yeah.
spilled coffee on my notebook
like my
or something.
Yeah.
Way to go, Wyrick. But thank you guys so much for being here. It's such a pleasure. And we'd love to have you guys back on anytime you'd like.
You bet,
thank
man.
Thank you.
Thank you. Take care now.
Okay, thanks. So, that is another episode of The Addendum for you. And every week, as the injustices of the criminal court system are brought to light, I'm reminded of the folks who've gone through this, you know, seen its worst attributes, who, by all rights, should be cynical, jaded, and ready to give up on it, but they remain dedicated to fixing it. And one of them is Christopher Scott. He was wrongfully convicted of capital murder and spent 13 years in prison before he was exonerated. He has spent his freedom fighting for the release of wrongfully convicted persons who are still incarcerated, as well as advocating for legislative changes. He recently founded the House of Renewed Hope, where Christopher is joined by fellow exonerees Johnny Lindsay and Stephen Phillips as they investigate innocence claims under the supervision of attorney Michelle Moore. And you can reach them on the web at houseofrenewedhope.org. And this organization was brought to me by Ellen, so thank you very much, Ellen. Fans can discuss the show on Twitter at #undisclosed or #justiceforjoey. If you want to tag questions for us for future addenda, please do and tweet them at any time. Just hashtag them with UDAddendum. We always need new questions, and we'll even take old questions if you have questions about previous episodes. Please do. You can also tweet them directly at me at Mr. John Cryer. Also, I'm still considering worthy organizations for the wrongfully convicted, so if you'd like to send me some and for me to consider donating to them, let me know. Send them to me. And as always, there's new case documents and photos posted weekly at undisclosed-podcast.com. You can follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at the handle @UndisclosedPod, and also our key partner, the Georgia Innocence Project, at GA Innocence. I'm going to thank Hannah McCarthy once again, and also Rebecca Lavoy of Partners in Crime Media for auto production, Patrick Cortez for composing the new addenda theme, and Methil Telhan, who is our project manager. Thank you once again, Methil. I want to give a very, very sincere thank you to our listeners. I've gotten news in the last couple of weeks that the amount of downloads on the show has been nothing short of spectacular, and that is all your fault, frankly. So I'm incredibly grateful. I don't know what you people are doing, but just keep doing it. It's really gratifying for us here at Undisclosed that the show is resonating with people, and we're going to bring you a lot more great shows, so please stay tuned.